Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been an unprecedented year with a global pandemic, an election that took days to decide with a record number of votes, and now a defeated incumbent president who is refusing to concede. Joining us now to help put things in perspective is George Will. He's provided commentary on American politics and foreign affairs in newspaper columns and broadcast appearances for more than 40 years. He writes a biweekly column for The Washington Post through a conservative lens, and he's also the author of several books, including The Conservative Sensibility, which was published last year and was the last time we spoke with George Will on this program. I should also note that Will is a native of Champaign, Illinois, and attended University Laboratory High School, not far from Illinois Public Media's studios, where the 21st is produced. George Will, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here. And listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. You can do so by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. I want to begin. Yesterday, NBC reported that President Trump's advisors are saying he may never admit to the fact that he lost this election, even as votes are certified in the coming weeks. I wonder what you think about the president's response to the 2020 election results.
Well, first of all, it's in character. It matters.
And we seem to be having some difficulty with the audio there, so we're going to try and reconnect with George Will. Maybe try dialing again. The connection is not what we want to hear. In the meantime, I will just remind listeners, take a moment to promote our Text the 21st group. We're still planning out our segments for next week. We've got a lot of interesting topics, and we do love hearing listener input as we put those together. You can join that by texting the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, you send the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. And, you know, as ever, we all do like to hear from listeners. If you ever want to leave us a comment, let us know what you think about what we're talking about. You can just send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also leave us a voicemail. We finally got our voicemail back up and running. The number there is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. So I'm giving a lot of numbers. Don't want to get too confusing. I think we have George Will back with us, hopefully on a better phone line. So I was just asking about, you know, the president's refusal to concede, and what's your sort of initial take on his response to the 2020 election?
Well, as I was saying, it's bad manners, but bad manners are one of his defining characteristics and one of the things about him that appeals to those who find him appealing. It's not harmless by any means, although it's without legal consequence. It's not harmless in that it will further embitter his supporters, many of whom are bitter enough already. But in the 19th century, an American public intellectual, Margaret Fuller, rather grandly said, "I accept the universe," to which Thomas Carlyle said, "By gad, she'd better." I feel somewhat the same way about Mr. Trump's refusing to concede. Who cares if at noon on January 20th, he's still in the White House, he will be trespassing in public housing and will be expelled. Long before that, the Electoral College votes will be cast. Even before that, all 50 states and the District of Columbia will certify their election results. So the world is going to march right on without really caring whether he gives us the nicety of a formal concession.
You know, there's a house down the street from me that for a long time on its flagpole out front had a Trump 2020 flag above one of those thin blue line pro-police flags. I don't get out much these days because of the pandemic, but I did notice last night that both flags have been replaced by your standard issue 50-star American flag. And I wonder if you have a sense of whether the reluctance to accept the results of this election, is that primarily limited to the tenants at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, or is this a broader phenomena?
I think it's fairly small. I think that we know that in a nation of 330 million people, some people are stark raving mad, and other people are easily deluded. And I'm sure there are many people who are used to taking seriously what a president says. And when he says there's vote fraud in Arizona and Pennsylvania, et cetera, they say, well, there must be fire where there's so much smoke. And that's the cost of this. But put it in perspective. Most of the 330 million Americans are getting on with their lives, and they know that this too shall pass. And shortly after noon on January 20th, America is going to look fairly stable and serene.
I appreciate your optimism here. I have heard some commentators, the New Yorker writer Jelani Cobb, for example, worrying that President Trump's strong showing in the election, right? He got the most votes cast ever in an American presidential election, except for Vice or President-elect Biden, of course. But that means that Trumpism, right? This, at least President Trump's style of campaigning and mode of being in public life are going to hang around, like, and this is Cobb's words, some sort of presidential lost cause narrative. Is that something that worries you?
Partly, but not terribly. It seems to me that the history of populisms in the United States, going back to George Wallace in 68, when he actually carried some electoral votes, or Ross Perot in 1992, he got no electoral votes, but he got 19.7% of the popular vote. But when Wallace disappeared, Wallaceism disappeared. When Perot disappeared, the gas went out of that balloon. I think Trumpism has been Trump. Now, there are those in the Republican Party. Josh Hawley, the freshman senator from Missouri, is the most conspicuous example, and making himself conspicuous is his specialty. He exemplifies those who want to have the thinking person's Trumpism. Now, that strikes me as an oxymoron, but they think that they can infuse Trumpism, this kind of populism, with intellectual content and go on from here. There's nothing wrong with the message. The messenger this year was somewhat flawed. I think what they're missing is that the messenger was the message, that Mr. Trump's behavior was not something people voted for him in spite of, but largely because of. And when he's gone, I think this is apt to look like a spent force, an exhausted volcano.
You left the Republican Party in 2016. Can you remind our listeners why you decided to leave, and if what gets you back? Right, that's the question.
Well, first of all, I'm not in a hurry to go back because I rather like being a free agent. On June 2nd, this was well before he was actually nominated, but he'd clinched the nomination. On June 2nd, my friend, the then Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, intelligent, cheerful, public-spirited, very informed on policy matters, endorsed Trump. So the next morning I left the Republican Party on the sound reasoning that if someone as serious and congenial as Paul Ryan was going to endorse Trump, he was going to be normalized. And you can't normalize this fella. He's not normal and should not be considered normal. So Paul was the straw that broke my back. And I'm in no hurry to go back, particularly because when you watch the way Republicans are behaving in the midst of this protracted non-concession, you realize just how deep the rot is in the Republican Party.
Have you been surprised? A lot of people say, you know, you can't be surprised anymore. But I wonder if you have continued to be surprised at how members of the Republican Party have responded to President Trump, or maybe the point is how they're responding to his voters.
Well, that's right. I think every Republican in Congress has a large, probably a majority of their constituents are Trump enthusiasts. And you can't expect them to casually offend those people. I would divide the Republicans right now into two camps. Mitch McConnell, I admire very much and have known for decades. Mitch McConnell has no use for Donald Trump, never has. He has, however, an intense interest in preserving the Republican majority, and therefore he's not going to get crosswise with Trump and get into a tweeting storm with Trump as long as he needs, as he does desperately need, the Trump voters in Georgia, and it's approximately half the voters in Georgia, in the two runoff elections for Senate seats on January 5th, after which I think you'll see a very different attitude on the part of Mitch McConnell and some others. There are others like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham. Ted Cruz suggesting Pennsylvania should do a do-over in this vote. Lindsey Graham, who knows less about Philadelphia than a pig knows about Sunday, saying we all know that elections in Philadelphia are corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. The Cruz-Graham egregious, over-the-top endorsement of Trump is something very different.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, the hero of the Republican Party for so long, at least in my lifetime, has been Ronald Reagan, right? People have looked up to him. Last year, you were interviewed for the Reagan Foundation, and you said, and I think you look at people like Ted Cruz as somebody who at least 5-6 years ago would have pointed to President Reagan as somebody that he wanted to emulate in public life. And you said President Reagan was polite and dignified. Those are words that few, even in the Republican Party, have used to describe President Trump. How does the Republican Party, who widely supports Reagan 40 years ago, go from there to George W. Bush for two terms, to, you know, through Senator McCain, Governor Romney, Senator Romney now, to where it is now?
It's the eagerness to turn the party into a cult of personality. It is the sense that they looked at this Mr. Trump with his feral cunning about the nature of a significant portion of the American people and said, we're going where the success is. They admire success, and they have very little intellectual ballast other than that. The good news is that just as they are like windsocks on old rural airports that are empty except for the telling you which way the wind is blowing, they're apt to come around and be just as malleable when fashion changes and new political leadership emerges. So I don't think they're ever going to be admirable, but they will not be as contemptible as their current behavior is.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Washington Post columnist George Will. He's the author of several books, including most recently, The Conservative Sensibility. If you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You've talked about President Trump leaving the scene, right? And I have heard this idea. There was another... I can't remember who it was in one of the many radio or podcast programs I was listening to said, you know, a fish out of the freezer for a couple of weeks begins to be something you don't want to have lying around on the counter anymore. But I wonder, I mean, it seems that he is, you know, there's also talk of him creating a media empire, either, you know, creating his own television network, sort of trying to do a takeover of one of the existing television networks that attempts to appeal to those people. Could he remain a force in American politics?
He can remain a force, but I think a radically diminished force. About his future business plans, remember, the one thing we know about Mr. Trump is he's a spectacularly incompetent businessman. Four bankruptcies. His father gave him about $200 million in 1984 or so. If he'd put that $200 million in an index fund and had played golf all the subsequent years, he'd be wealthier than he is today. We don't know how wealthy he is, but we do know that he's not nearly as wealthy as he claims to be, which is to say that he lies about his wealth as he lies about everything else. And one of the reasons, surely, that he has been hiding his tax returns is he doesn't want people to know that, in fact, he's a bogus billionaire.
I want to turn now, we do need to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but to the Senate. It seems increasingly likely that President-elect Biden is not going to have a Democratic Senate, as many Democrats had hoped. There were a few states that split tickets, like Maine, that went for Biden, but have a Republican senator and Susan Collins. I wonder how you think and again, this depends on the outcome of the Georgia runoff elections, but how do you think if it is a Republican Senate that that could influence a Biden presidency? Do you see Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, shifting from the strategy he used under President Obama of not working, obstructing, not confirming appointments, to trying to work with President Biden, President-elect Biden?
Mitch McConnell has been in the Senate 36 years. Joe Biden was in the Senate for 36 years. No president has ever had as much congressional experience as Joe Biden had. Gerry Ford had 24 years, Lyndon Johnson had 24 years, Biden had 50% more than they do. So I think Biden genuinely reveres the institution of Congress, and particularly the Senate. Neither he nor McConnell really want to get rid of the filibuster. McConnell wants to end some of the promiscuous use of the filibustering, particularly for executive appointments that do not extend beyond the life of the Biden administration. No more of doing what both parties have done and the Democrats have been doing recently, which is essentially stalling on assistant secretaries of this and that. So I think there will be an attempt to improve the mood. But basically, if that happens, then a Republican Senate will be a blessing for Joe Biden, because he can turn to the progressive wing of the party, which was fairly soundly thumped in the elections on November 3rd, and say, look, you got us into trouble with defund the police, Medicare for all, statehood for Puerto Rico, statehood for the District of Columbia. And he'll be able to turn to them and say, I'm sorry, the Republican Senate simply precludes us wasting time on these doomed causes, and we have to talk about things that the American people are actually interested in.
Okay, well, we're going to continue this conversation. One of the things the American people are interested in is a more competent response to the global pandemic that's afflicting us all. We're going to talk about that and more with George Will when we come back. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with columnist George Will. He's got a biweekly column in The Washington Post. He's author of many books, including most recently The Conservative Sensibility, published in 2019. He's also a native of Champaign, Illinois. And listeners, if you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I want to pivot now to the pandemic. You recently wrote, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but you wrote that the largest lesson of the pandemic is that where the lumbering, overstretched state, overpromising, underperforming, forfeited citizens' confidence, resulting in a surge in COVID-19. Where do you think the federal government went wrong with its pandemic response?
First, before it had a pandemic to respond to, it was not planning for pandemics, which we know have been part of the human story for as long as there has been a human story. So there should have been much more abundant planning. Second, we had the Centers for Disease Control has been a stark example of mission creep, taking on all kinds of social causes that are at best peripheral to what its title focuses it on, which is Centers for Disease Control. The reason the CDC is located in Atlanta is Atlanta was a hotbed of malaria when malaria was raging in the South many decades ago. That's what the CDC is for and is good at, and should be returned to that mission. Third, we had the obvious nonsensical statements emanating from the highest reaches of American government, I mean the White House press room, that badly misled people about the seriousness of this. And we had the president dividing his time between ostentatiously not wearing a mask and denouncing Anthony Fauci. clearly, it seems to me that one of the great whipping boys of American public life recently has been the pharmaceutical industry, and maybe, just maybe, people will pause for a moment and say, well, it certainly was good to have Pfizer out there to do what pharmaceutical companies are rather good at, which is developing new drugs.
I want to go now to the phones. We have a caller on the line. Jerry is in Peoria. Jerry, thanks for calling in. What's your question for George Will?
Well, I have two. First of all, I'm class of 60, and I'm just wondering if you're going to be attending the 100th anniversary gala next year, assuming that we have one. And more seriously, the second question is the effects of the Republican legislators failing to support their election results as far as their near future ambitions.
Okay, Jerry, thank you for the call. I presume he's referring to Uni High there?
I hope so.
Yeah.
that's right, Uni High. Lord, how old is it? I think you're going to watch Senator Langford of Oklahoma. Just yesterday on the radio said if Trump doesn't get out of the way of Biden interfering, Biden receiving the kind of security briefings, daily security briefings that any president elect should have, that he, Langford, will, and he didn't say quite how, but there'll be a kind of intervention here. And I think you're going to see this now. Every Republican in Congress knows, and almost every Republican in Congress welcomes the fact that Joe Biden will be inaugurated at noon on the 20th of January, just whiz. So there's a lot of kabuki theater here involved in A, placating their disappointed bases, and B, looking forward to the two runoff elections on January 5th in Georgia, after which there'll be a sea change, abrupt and thorough.
Okay, well, we will watch for that. In just a couple of minutes we have remaining, I want to sort of go big picture with you. And I wonder, one of the questions that's been animating me for many years now as a journalist is this question of what politics is for, and if we've lost sight of that. I wonder if you have a perspective on whether Americans, in sort of the increasing either polarization or maybe the way, and I guess this is not necessarily a new phenomenon, but the idea of politics as a hobby, politics as a sports team, as a religion, it seems, for some people, you know, have we lost sight of what politics and government is really for?
Well, I think it's, you know, politics is for many things. Basically, someone has to rule and it assigns power. Now, that we get. And under our system of government, it often assigns divided power to a divided government. And Americans must rather like that because they so regularly produce it. And they're not wrong to. There's a sense in which gridlock is not an American problem, it's an American achievement. There are a great many people in this world live under governments they wish were capable of being gridlocked. Beyond that, politics has always had, in America particularly, in our raucous, tumultuous country, at least since the Jacksonian era, when mass mobilization politics really began in the late 1820s and into the 1830s, has always had a large entertainment dimension. It's been public speaking, orator. Before there was the internet and Netflix and television and radio, there was politics and oratory. I mean, when Lincoln and Douglas debated in seven towns around the state of Illinois, they would stand in front of crowds of 20,000 people without amplified sound, so most of the people listening couldn't hear them. And, of course, none of the people listening could vote for them because senators then were elected by the state legislatures. But the Lincoln-Douglas debates were part of the entertainment function of politics. And it's not a civically irrelevant thing. The fact that Americans have always had enthusiasm for politics as a sport, as a competitive, entertaining enterprise, is not unhealthy, frankly.
You had this turn of phrase in one of your recent columns that I really love. It stuck with me. You talked about a public evenly divided by mutual incomprehension. And certainly it seems that whatever, you know, after President Biden is, or President-elect Biden is sworn in January, there are still going to be 74, 75 million Americans who think, I cannot understand for the life of me what those other 70 million people were thinking, and probably the same on the other side, right?
Absolutely.
How do we rebuild a fundamental sense of citizenship and fellow feeling for other Americans?
I think Joe Biden can, and I expect Joe Biden to, change this by lowering the temperature. He's not a screamer. He's not a man of anger. And I think after a few months of a president who isn't in our face all the time, who isn't in our living rooms all the time, a president who is a little less ubiquitous, that I think America will go off the boil. And at that point, some of the incomprehension will be of people saying, what were we thinking when we thought the fate of the republic depended on this or that election? This country was not made by flimsy people, and it is not a flimsy country. And elections usually do not put at risk the essentials of American life.
George Will, you can find his column in the Washington Post, or more than likely syndicated in a newspaper near you. Sorry.
And
the News Gazette, I think certainly in the State Journal Register in Springfield. And his most recent book is called The Conservative Sensibility. It's out now in paperback. And you can find our interview with Mr. Will on that book in our podcast website archive, 21stshow.org. George Will, thank you for speaking with us today on the 21st.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.